happening all the time, which leads some people to think that somehow what's wrong with today if it's not happening today or something like that. Also, even though there are long periods without biblical miracles, there are some periods with a lot. So the time of the Exodus, the time of the divided kingdom, and the time of Jesus' ministry on earth, as well as the apostolic age, are all times when there are a lot of miracles. There are sort of bursts of miracles in these time periods. And it's important for us to understand what the purpose of miracles are. They're not for sensationalism. They have a purpose. And when it comes to the New Testament, let's look at a couple passages that help us with this. Let's look at John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31. Zach, will you read that for us? John 20, 30 and 31. This is the commentary made by the writer of the Gospel of John about the work of Jesus after his resurrection. Read that for us, please, Zach. Thank you.
Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name.
What's the reason why Jesus did miracles?
So that we believe.
You would believe.
So people would believe what? That he's the Son of God. So it's to prove his identity. Earlier in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, if you don't believe my words, John 10, believe the works that I do. It's not what I say, it's what I do. And so it's very clear all through the Gospel accounts that's the case. And I'm sure you had some good discussions about that when you were looking at the Gospels, the miracles in the Gospels. Look with me to Hebrews chapter 2, because we see a continuation of miracles performed by the apostles of Christ, as well as others associated with the apostles in the first several years after Jesus ascends back to the Father. So in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Elaine, could you read that for us, please? Hebrews 2, 1 to 4.
For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? After it was at the first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those who heard, God also bearing witness with them, both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will.
So you see, thank you. You see the linkage there, the continuation that Jesus spoke, and then these other people spoke after him. And this mentions that as they spoke, their message was accompanied by signs, miracles, and wonders. So in the case of Jesus, the signs and miracles were to prove who he was, his identity. But with the apostles and others who heard him, who were commissioned with his word, the apostles and some of the first believers, it was not to confirm their identity, certainly not as the Messiah. Again, what's the purpose of them doing miracles? That's right. To authenticate, to confirm, to put an official stamp on the message they spoke, which, according to this text, didn't start with them. It started with the Lord, it continued with them, and it's authenticated by the miracles and signs and wonders. So when you read the book of Acts, that's exactly what's happening. In the book of Acts, you've got people going around and preaching the gospel, and the signs and miracles and wonders confirm that it was the true gospel, the message from God through Jesus Christ. Their day was no different than ours, in the sense that there were people saying things that weren't true. People trying to get power and glory, to protect themselves, to make money. And they would claim things and say things that were not the case. The first century world had a problem with charlatans. People would go from one community to another and they would claim to have some kind of power. And we actually see an example of a guy, though it appears he's at least located for a while, and that's Simon in the book of Acts earlier, the sorcerer, who was amazing people with his deeds. But we know it was not of God. And so this was not an uncommon problem. So how do you distinguish between a Simon before conversion and an Apostle Paul? And so it's these signs, miracles, and wonders that confirm that they were extending to people the same message that Christ had preached. It's the true word from God. So understand that they're not happening all the time, but when they do, there's a purpose. And you always got to ask, what's the purpose? It's very important. And then there is this subject. And by the way, thank you for whoever designed this schedule for giving me demon possession for my first Bible class. You're welcome. Yeah, thanks, Rick. No, you were just taking the text. I chose to come when I came, right? So it's on me. But demon possession. So there are going to be a lot of things tonight you may have questions about. And feel free to ask them. And I can tell you right now, there's a good chance I won't have an answer. There's quite a few things about demon possession that I don't know about. As a matter of fact, if you really want an interesting conversation starter, say, hey, let's talk about demon possession. If it's a Christian or not a Christian, that's an interesting conversation starter. Demon possession. So, I got a really good story about that, by the way. And it's actually a great evangelistic story. So I'm going to tell it, okay? So, back when I first started preaching and I was in Maryland, I met a guy who was a Christian, been a Christian for several years. His name was Ron. And he was a character. And he's passed now. He passed in a tragic accident, actually. And Ron told me his story about being converted, and it was something else. He was raised totally irreligious. He was wild growing up, out of control, got into everything. Went to Vietnam, kept re-upping in Vietnam, and they had put him under psychological evaluation because nobody was doing that. Because he just loved to go outdoors and shoot guns and cause trouble. And I mean, he was just a wild person. And not long after that, he was back in America, and this probably rings true if you're over a certain age. He went and saw the movie The Exorcist. Not that I recommend that movie, but from a cultural standpoint, you probably want to Wikipedia that just to sort of get an idea of what that is, okay? This was the kind of person that he would go in bars and pick fights just for the fun of it. He said, I slept with my lights on for a week. He said, I never believed in God. I didn't believe in anything but me. And he said, for a week he slept with the lights on. He was scared to death. And he began to wonder, is there a higher power? He started reading the Bible. Well, you know how it ended. He went to all these different churches and he finally found one that was teaching the Bible and he became a Christian. And he was a very interesting character. But that's how he came to get interested in the gospel, was through the movie The Exorcist. Because demon possession, which is highlighted in the movie, if you know what I mean, it's pretty intense. I'm not saying there are incidents like that in the New Testament, but there are some pretty intense incidents involving demon possession in the New Testament. Guys breaking chains and things like that over in the gospel. So it's a very unusual topic, isn't it? It's an extreme topic. So let's just bite a few pieces off of this. Again, looking at it from a broad perspective. First of all, demon possession, as it's recorded in the Bible, parallels the coming of Christ. Now, the Old Testament also is filled with a lot of unusual events. Floating axe heads and seas being parted and, those plagues of gnats and flies and all those. A lot of unusual things. You don't really see demon possession like you see in the book of Luke and John and Matthew and Mark and the book of Acts. You just really don't see it like that. You have some references to demons and spirits, but not that. And I think that this is legitimate, when you look at the literature after the New Testament, what people were writing about 100 years, 200 years, 300 years after the close of the New Testament, they're not writing about demon possession. It's interesting because people still today like to claim that it happens. But among the early, what are called the church writers, church fathers, you don't see it. And so just as Christ came to earth, on earth, you see at the same time demons starting to possess humans on earth. And again, I don't think it was common, but it happened. So what are we talking about here? Go over with me earlier in the book of Acts, the 5th chapter, where the work of the apostles in the early days after the resurrection is chronicled here, and they're in Jerusalem, and it's before the persecution got really, really intense. Look at Acts chapter 5 and read for us verse 12 and 16. Tristan, did I get your name right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks for responding. Read verse 12 of chapter 5 and then verse 16, please.
Now many signs and wonders were regularly done among the people by the hands of the apostles. And they were all together in Solomon's portico. None of the rest dared join them, but the people held them high in esteem. And more than ever, believers were added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women, so that they even carried out the sick into the streets and laid them on cots and mats, that as Peter came by, at least his shadow might fall on them. The people also gathered them from the towns around Jerusalem, bringing the sick and those afflicted with unclean spirits, and they were all healed.
All right, thank you. So, just as we saw stated in Hebrews chapter 2, there was an impact on others around them when they saw the miracles of the apostles. This is going to authenticate their role in being the messengers of Christ. And something is stated here in Acts 5 that you see also in the Gospels. And that is, when there is one of these summary statements about miracles, and there are things like various diseases and different sick people were healed, oftentimes evil spirits, people being possessed by evil spirits or demons and they being cast out, is also thrown in there. So it's in this same category that this is something that arrives on earth at the time that Christ arrives on earth, and the miracles that Christ did to prove his identity and the miracles the apostles were performing to prove their message was from Christ, as it included healing people who were sick. It also included casting out demons. So what was this demon thing about? How was it manifested? When you put all of it together, you see that a spirit being, an evil spirit being, sometimes called a demon, would possess someone's human body. Oftentimes the person had no control over their body. The person would be put through harm or danger or do extreme things, like the child that was rolled into the fire and things like that. In the book of Matthew, it referenced that by his father. I mentioned the man that was demon-possessed over on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. It's talked about, I think, in 3 of the Gospels. And he would break chains and rip off his clothing and things such as that. So there was some kind of physical, you know, demonstration that this person was not right, that they were in charge of their bodies, that a normal person wouldn't do those things. There is no indication, and I think it's important to note this, that that person's soul, that the condition of their soul was changed. There is no evidence that somehow their soul was possessed by evil spirits, and thus they were a rebel before God and condemned because a demon had taken them over. Do I have to reference Flip Wilson? Right? Again, I'm just splitting this audience right down the middle on age, aren't I? Right there with the Exorcist of Flip Wilson, because it all happened about the same time. So a comedian used to say, the devil made me do it. And I don't think there is any indication that spiritually the person was possessed, but they were possessed in their body. I think it's the reason I bring this up is people want to squeeze too much out of these things. And all that we know about God says he holds people accountable because of their choices, not because of what they can't help but to do. We see that all through the scriptures. And oftentimes this evil spirit would communicate. They would use the human body to communicate. And I hope that if you were troubled by The Exorcist, I'm not bringing up bad memories, because that happened in that movie. It is a bizarre thing that a spirit would speak through this person. And you see several instances of that, including the one we're going to look at tonight. Most importantly, what these miracles of casting out demons prove is that there was no contest. It's not an arm wrestling match between two brutes. You know, you see those arm wrestling matches, you know, and the guys are just straining and the arms aren't going anywhere. When God confronts evil, it's not a tug of war like that. Whenever Christ went to cast out a demon, he did it. He didn't struggle to do it. He didn't battle to do it. And you'll see that in this text tonight, how Paul does it. There's no battle. And the reason why is because there's no contest between the power of God and the power of evil. It's and a lot of people sort of in their worldview and even outside of, influences of Christianity, but even inside influences of Christianity, people have this idea that God and Satan's having this kind of battle and we think God's going to win and we hope God's going to win. No. It's no contest. And the book of Revelation proves that too in a very powerful, illustrative kind of way. But it does symbolize God's great power and his victory over evil and how he's using that power to deliver human beings. We oftentimes, and no wonder, because what the prophets say about miracles with the coming of the Messiah, as well as some things that Jesus says about miracles, such as John 9 and the healing of the man born blind, we cannot help but to connect the physical miracles to spiritual salvation. And Jesus does it. The man is let down. This is all in three of the Gospels. The man's let down by his friends to the roof of the house. And Jesus talks about forgiving his sins and saying, take up your bed and walk. He says, because I can say one like I can say the other. Because that's what Jesus does. He saves, he delivers, he rescues. And oftentimes the physical and the spiritual are put together. Now, it's not that. That was Jesus' main purpose because Jesus left a lot of unhealed people. But Jesus offered the way for everyone to be spiritually delivered and saved. But those physical miracles symbolize his power to save and deliver. And certainly we are to see demon possession and the casting out of evil spirits the same way. Once again, it shows God's going to deliver us from evil. So just like the Lord's Prayer says. Well, it's about time we got into this, right? I mean, you've been waiting to get into this. So let's read this. Narrative of Acts chapter 16, verse 16 to verse 24. But first of all, let's set the stage here, the situation of what's going on. Paul, with various companions in the book of Acts, from about halfway through the book on, is traveling around and spreading the gospel, helping to plant churches, on some occasions going back and visiting churches where he's been before. And Acts chapter 16 finds us in Paul's second missionary journey, as far as the journeys recorded in the book of Acts. Probably had more than that. It is also right after what is called the Macedonian call. Paul is in Asia Minor, which is sort of his home region. He is trying to push further up into Asia, what we call today Turkey. He's trying to push further up into what we know as that southwestern Asian area, but the Spirit would not allow him to go there, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit. But rather, he had a vision of a man calling him to come over to Macedonia. Macedonia was the region just north of Greece proper, where Alexander the Great's father hailed from, Philip of Macedon. And it was a Greek area, and it was a Macedonian area, and the Macedonians sort of embraced the Greek way. And geographically, it's Europe. So it's a very different place. And Paul is called to come over there, and this is why he ends up in Philippi, which is a very important city. It's a place where people had Roman citizenship. So it's a very favored place by the Roman Empire. And there he meets a handful of Jewish women. There's not enough Jews in Philippi to occupy a synagogue. So he meets these Jewish women who are praying by the river. He begins to teach the gospel, he and his companions. And that's the start of conversions in the church in Philippi. He's got with him Silas. And if you know carefully, you'll see the personal pronoun we in us in this reading. So the writer of the book of Acts is with Paul at this point, which is part of the evidence that helps us to track down who the writer of Acts is, which is also the writer of Luke because of the way both books are introduced. And you put all the evidence together and you conclude it's Luke. So that's the situation. And so they're in Philippi. They've got sort of a little traction. They've converted a few people and they're continuing to, you know, strike at their work here. And this happens. So, Rick, will you read for us Acts 16, 16 to 24, please?
And it happened that as we were going to the place of prayer, a certain slave girl having a spirit of divination met us, who was bringing her masters much profit by fortune telling. Following after Paul and us, she kept crying out, saying, "These men are bond servants of the Most High God, who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation." And she continued doing this for many days. But Paul was greatly annoyed and turned and said to the spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out at that very moment. But when her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the authorities. And when they had brought them to the chief magistrates, they said, "These men are throwing our city into confusion, being Jews, and are proclaiming customs which it is not lawful for us to accept or to observe, being Romans." And the crowd rose up together against them, and the chief magistrates tore the robes off them and proceeded to order them to be beaten with rods. And when they had inflicted many blows upon them, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to guard them securely. And he, having received such a command, threw them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks.
All right, thank you. So let's dissect this narrative here and look at this. Let me ask you some questions. First of all, she's identified as a slave girl in most translations. By the way, I use the English Standard Version. Slave girl. She's young. A teenager, young adult, whatever. Is she an older child? Don't know. Slave girl. In what way is she a slave twofold here? She is possessed by owners. What? Go ahead, Rick.
She's a slave to Satan.
Right. So she has owners or masters who possess her. A slave is a possession. And her body is being possessed by Satan. It's evil spirit. When you think you have it bad, right? A female slave in the first century. A young female slave. And you see here how she's being exploited, right? How is she being used? Right. And again, I hope, Elaine, you have no questions about this, because I don't have any answers.
No questions.
Great. My favorite student tonight. There is not another example of a demon-possessed person in the New Testament being able to tell fortunes, divine. And the idea there is predict the future. Divining is to predict the future. It might even be, this is possible, that she's actually not saying anything that's true, but because she's demon-possessed and it shows somehow that people are amazed by her and they think she's got special powers, so her masters are using her to make money, and she may be telling them, "Yeah, you're going to be rich next week," and they're not. I don't know. I don't know if she's actually telling fortunes or not, or if it's just like, you know, that guy down the street who's got the psychic sign. And also, he's a notary public, you know, that guy. And I just made it up. It'd be hilarious if there's a guy down the street like that. So let me know if there is. I might need a notary. But I don't know how to explain this, except they're exploiting her. That's what we know. And what did the demon communicate through her? More than once.
Who Paul and Silas were.
That's right. Identify them as what, Vince?
They are servants of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation.
Do you see that connection to Hebrews 2? Isn't that unusual? Hebrews 2 says they did miracles to prove they had the word of salvation. That they were the messengers of salvation. Here, before they even do the miracle, the slave girl, and we understand the evil spirit is what's possessing her to do this, the demon is announcing, these are the men that announce salvation to you. Not who we would want to endorse us, right? But that's how it went down. Which is significant because a lot of people have been listening to this slave girl. They've been paying money to listen to her. Now they get a free message. Now, does this remind you of anything with earlier demon possessions over in the Gospels? What, Rick? You're nodding your head.
That happened with Jesus on more than one occasion.
Yeah. Yeah. The demon says, I know who you are. You know, you're the Holy One. You're the one from on high and things like that. And oftentimes Jesus would do what when they would start talking?
Silence.
He would rebuke them for speaking. He didn't want people believing in him because of what the demon said. He was going to do it through other means. But it is still a powerful testimony. You see, there's no contest. And you really see this in the Gospels more than here. Those demons are actually fearful of Jesus, aren't they? Like the one who's the man on the inside of the Sea of Galilee that's possessed. And he's like, you know, and even other occasions, are you here to judge us before the time? They know who Jesus is. They know his power. They know he is the judge. And they're petrified of him. It's not a battle. And I think that's where The Exorcist misses it, is what I remember of it. I've not seen it. Lori saw it and told me about it. But that is where men want to twist things, right? Men want to twist things. And the idea is that there is no struggle here. And the demons are actually intimidated by Jesus. And here, there's good reason to be intimidated by what Paul can do. You have your hand? Thought I saw a hand. Okay, sorry. So that's a very interesting thing here that happens. And it happens more than once. And what prompts Paul to cast out the evil spirit is happening day after day. And what does it say? What's the text say? He's greatly annoyed and does this. I mean, this is a really interesting text. Whenever we see apostles doing miracles, you know, and Jesus doing miracles, sometimes there's a statement made about they had mercy on the people or something like that. And we understand that without being said, when you see someone blind or someone lame, you would understand the compassion being demonstrated by this. This text says, day after day after day, demons saying this, and finally Paul just turns, he's had enough, and casts the demon out. In what manner and in what time frame did he do this? How long did it take him to do it? Yeah. And again, what manner did he use? Some kind of weapon or tool or potion or...
In the name of Jesus Christ.
All right. He just spoke. As it happens throughout the Bible, when there is a miracle performed, reflective of Genesis 1, God speaks or God's messenger speaks. That's all that's necessary because it's the power of God. And look at the linkage between the power of God and the word of God and the messenger of God. And it is not an iffy thing. It happens immediately. And then the owners, the masters of the slave girl, well, why are they upset? Their income's dried up. So what are the charges they bring against Paul, Silas, and Luke? Evidently, Luke either is not there or is not associated with this because as Paul and Silas were thrown into the prison, as we said later. We'll come back to this later. What are the charges?
They're bringing trouble to their city.
Trying. These men are bringing trouble to the city. How are they troubling the city? How are they troubling the city? They were troubling the city.
Probably had something to do with the customs of the Romans. The clash between what Paul and Silas was teaching is going against the Roman
people. You do see some of those charges. I think you see that in Acts 19 in Ephesus. And, you know, really what they disturbed is what? Not the whole city, but what? The master's what?
Losing money.
Yeah, their business venture. Disturbed their money making. And they attach that these men are Jews. Why do you think they add that? Does that have anything to do with this miracle? It's irrelevant. Irrelevant. There are some Gentiles that Paul eventually takes with him on some of these journeys, and interacts with them. And there's some evidence maybe Luke is. I'm not quite sure. I think they make some theory that Luke might have been Gentile. But why are they using these Jews have come here and disturbed the city? Why are they using them? Just like they're saying they're disturbing the city and they're not. It's hyperbole. Why don't they throw in their identity as their ethnicity? And this goes to your point, Elaine. How did most Gentiles see Jews? Especially Romans, and this is a very Roman city, Philippi is, by the way. It's more of a Roman city in some ways than Greek city.
Kind of rebellious sort.
Their customs?
Yeah, their customs were different. They're odd people. They believe in only one God. Jews were seen as weirdos. Okay? That's how they were seen. And they had all these exceptions to the Roman Empire. They didn't have to worship the Caesar once a year and all that kind of thing. And so they were despised. Just as Jews despised Gentiles. Some Jews did. So these are buzzwords. They've disturbed the city and they're Jews. And you can see that these words worked, right? Because what happens?
They're locked up.
Yeah.
Beaten first. Yeah.
Beaten and then locked up. So you can see what they're trying to do here. What? And they actually get the authorities involved, right? What do you make of the legal processes in this situation?
No trial.
Okay, it's not a process at all. It's sort of like a lynching almost. And one of the reasons why they quickly act is they're Jews and they assume that they don't have Roman citizenship, which most Jews don't. And so if you don't have Roman citizenship, guys, you don't have any rights in the Roman Empire. If you're a Roman citizen, you have a lot of the rights like Americans do today, like trials and speech and the idea of not being unfairly searched. And there are all kinds of protections you have as a Roman citizen. But they assume since they're Jews, they don't have those. So they're just going to work them over and throw them in the prison. And then we know later on that they find out that Paul actually had a citizenship and they're scared because they'd overstepped their bounds. But that's another account that we'll study, Lord willing, next Wednesday night. But as you can see here, Paul and Silas really are put through it. And that connects to part of that I want you to get from this text here in the last few minutes. What's being revealed to us in this narrative? First of all, it confirms that God is working through Paul as a messenger. I mean, that's just the bare bones at the skeletal level. When you look at the other texts that we looked at, remember what miracles are for. You can't drift from that, like the Hebrews 2:4 passage. It still goes back to Paul speaking a message. And even though Paul is aggravated and annoyed and turns and casts out the demon, ultimately what's happening here is that Paul is showing the power of God and thus authenticating the message of God coming through him. And there is a display of God's mercy and compassion on the young woman. When it says a slave girl and she's demon possessed, any reader is troubled by this. Any person that would have witnessed this young lady would have been troubled by her plight in life. And so this was a merciful thing that was done for her. First of all, the exploitation is going to be minimized now. That she could be exploited in other ways, but and that is seen here too. is that this was a square off, not between good and evil or God and Satan. This is a square off between Paul and Silas and the masters of this slave girl. They do this. The masters see it as an offense to them. And then they get them in trouble. And so you see two groups of people. You see one group that's exploiting someone. You see the other people who are trying to deliver someone. In a way, the world can be divided up in those two categories. And there's all kinds of degrees of exploitation. But the worst way that you can look at other people is, okay, what can they do for me? And maybe it takes an extreme example like this to drive home that point. But we've got to guard against that attitude when we look at people. Oh, what? Oh, that can help me get an interview. Oh, maybe that can borrow some money from them. Oh, maybe I can... Oh, maybe they'll introduce me to that girl I like or something like that. I mean, always looking at people in terms of what can I get out of them? That's a non-Christ way of looking at people. And we should look at people in the sense of what can I do for them? And then there's an irony here. Somebody's finished the thought. The men who cast out a demon, then what, Lord?
Are demonized.
I hadn't thought about that. That's a great way to look at it. Thank you for trumping my point there, but that's okay. They were demonized. They did a good thing, and they were made out to be the villains here. That's an irony. I hadn't thought about that. They were cast into a prison. They end up being shackled. When a demon took over somebody's body, they controlled the body. Now, Paul and Silas, they don't have control of their bodies. They can't leave the prison. Matter of fact, they can't even wander around the prison. They're in stocks. The men who cast out a demon with this divine power now themselves were thrown into prison. They were cast into a prison. It's a very ironic thing. But it really matches a lot of things that happens in the Gospels too. We see here that the miracles have a definite purpose. The power is not broad and indiscriminate. They're not going around, you know, just firing away miracles left and right. They're very targeted. They're very purposeful. Paul had encountered the demon for several days before he does it. Why? I don't know. That's how it went down. But what we see ultimately in this, the way this story ends up, we don't know what happens to the slave girl. When the narrative continues, it focuses on what's happening with Paul and Silas. And they're beaten, thrown into the prison, and locked in stocks. Now, it turns out really good later. We'll see that next week. But because they had the power to cast out the demon, didn't shield them from suffering. So think about this. What these men experienced here, especially Paul, the text says that Paul did the miracle. What are the parallels with Christ? What parallels do you see with what's happening here and what's happening with Paul and with Christ in the Gospel? And he did all kinds of miraculous deeds that freed people of demons and freed people of disease and even freed people of death. But though he freed people of death, he himself had to what? Die. Crucified. Not just die, but be punished in his death. Do you remember on the cross when some of the religious leaders came to taunt him? What was one of the things they said that was part of this irony that we're looking at?
He saved others. Himself he can't save.
Right. Mm-hmm. Come down from the cross. You saved others. Lame, blind, sick, demon-possessed, even dead. But you're up on that cross. You can't save yourself. I mean, you can look at Paul and say, look at you, Paul, locked in the stocks. You thought you were something else casting out that demon. Now look at you. It's ironic, but it's not inconsistent. That's God's plan. God's going to demonstrate power, but the demonstration of his power does not preclude or exclude suffering. And actually, when you look at the example of Jesus and the example of the apostles here, could you say that the closer you get to the power of God, the more suffering you have to endure? Isn't that a consistent statement with what we read in the Gospels and the book of Acts? Who had more power than Jesus on earth? He had ultimate power. He had divine power. He was God the Son in human flesh. But who suffered more as a human than Jesus? In every way imaginable, no one. And Jesus made that clear to his followers, didn't he? All right, what else do you have to add or ask or contribute?
The only thing that struck me is that, you know, you said it's ironic that Paul and Silas were cast in prison for freeing this girl. That's Satan right there. He said, you do this to me, I'm doing this to you. Basically, you almost see the tit for tat there.
Yeah. Oh, and that's interesting because, and not trying to get ahead of ourselves next week, but then God turns that inside out on Satan. Because in the prison, God is able to demonstrate his power again, which then endorses Paul and Silas again and leads to salvation of souls. And again, that's next week's lesson. But that's a good setup. And you're right, there is this struggle. It's not that Satan doesn't get blows in. But when Satan gets blows in, God is able to actually use those blows for his own good, for his own purposes.